Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the program. Professor Richard Wolff from Capitalism Hits the Fan fame. Going to be here talking about the economy, pretty much everything the economy tonight. Manufacturing Monday, we're going to talk about jobs. We're going to talk about all of the things that are I think we can fix. I think we can do some common sense things that will turn this country around, and a great conversation we'll have later with Barry Fox, president of the corporation called Marble King. In fact, I tell you, I didn't even know there were any marbles left in the U.S. that were made here. I thought those went the way of the of shoes and of clothing, one of those things that you think probably went years ago. But there is one last company that produces marbles, and we will talk to their president later on in the program. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out our website at thericksmithshow.com. A listener sent me this email with a link in it to the Vail Daily News. And I got to be honest, I've got to read through this because the headline reads, alleged hit-and-run driver may not face felony. Now, any of us, you, Jake, me, anybody, we hit somebody and we take off, you can bet that they are going to lock us up and throw away the key. Maybe not the case here. Eagle, Colorado. A financial manager for wealthy clients will not face felony charges for hit and run because it could jeopardize his job, according to prosecutors. It could jeopardize his job. Martin Joel Ezinger, 52, faces two misdemeanor traffic charges stemming from a July 3rd incident where he allegedly hit a bicyclist, Dr. Stephen Milo, from behind and then sped away. According to court documents, Milo and his attorney, Harold Handen, are livid about the prosecutor's decision to drop the felony charges. They filed their objection the day after the prosecutors notified their office with a fax. Now, you stop and think about this for a second. This is a doctor who got hit. This isn't just some schmo, some kid on a bike. This is actually a doctor. So if you stop and you really think, and my point in this is, if you think of the hierarchy in this country, you know, wealthy people seem to walk away with anything they do unscathed. Politicians seem to walk away unscathed. So the fact that it's a doctor for me that got hit says something. Because you would think in our class structure that a doctor is pretty high up on the list. You know, pretty close to the top. Evidently not high enough. Not high enough to, overtake a private wealth manager with Morgan Stanley Smith Barney there in Denver. His job is to make the very, very wealthy even more so. He's one of those guys that they're hiring now at Goldman Sachs and on Wall Street, one of these personal wealth managers. So he's not just some bank schlub. He's the guy who kisses the very, very, very wealthy's behind. He manages a portfolio of $1 billion. Now, this doctor, on vacation there in Vail with his family, a physician, his job, what he does for a living, he's a liver transplant surgeon. I'm talking way up, even on the food chain of doctors, way towards the top. He's got spinal cord injuries. He's got bleeding on the brain, damage to his knees and scapula, a bunch of stuff. And they're going to charge this guy who hit him from behind and ran off, as this doctor says, leaving me for dead. Leaving him for dead. Just sped off. A couple of misdemeanors. And the reason, the attorney said Thursday that, in part, this is what the article says, this is a case about money. The money has never been a priority for them. It is for us, the attorney said. Justice in this case includes restitution and the ability to pay. Stop and think about that for a minute. Hilbert, right, the attorney says, felony convictions have some pretty serious job implications for someone in Mr. Enziger's position, and that entered into it. When you're talking about restitution, you don't want to take away his ability to pay. Hold on. Did you ever see that in the law? If I were to hit somebody on a bicycle, they wouldn't give a rat's behind about my family, about my job, about anything. In fact, they would throw me in jail and take everything I own. But this guy, and this is, to me, this is indicative of our nation. This is really indicative of what's happened in this country, that we don't have a problem bailing out bankers. We don't have a problem letting the wealth class off with a slap on the wrist. We just don't seem to have a problem with that.
Be interesting to see if I was this gentleman and I got screwed by the system, I would try to find out, is there a connection? Is there a connection between those who made the decision and this wealthy investor? Is there a clear conflict of interest?
It doesn't say that there's anything, but the reality is, look, it's about the money here. And they're saying, well, you know, he's going to have to pay some restitution because he's going to have to pay for the doctor. No, that should not enter into this equation one iota. Did the guy take his car and hit this guy on the bike? The answer is yes. At that point, you could say, it was an accident, I'm sorry, whatever. No, not this guy. He hits the gas and takes off. At that moment, that is a felony. That is prison time. And if we let anybody off from that, anybody, I don't care how rich you are, that breaks down our legal system. And it destroys the rule of law. Frank Selman, a guy, writer over at Reuters, compares the charges being dropped to kind of involuntary, the invulnerability that bankers have felt for years leading up to the financial crisis, and I would even argue beyond. He says, quote, no matter how egregious their behavior, financiers knew that they would end up with wealthy and comfortable. That, in turn, made it much easier to overcome their natural risk aversion. Enziger has bought his way out of a felony charge over the strenuous objections of the victim. It's very unlikely that an online petition will do any good at this point. Just another thing to add to the list of things that money can buy. And I got to be honest, I'm right there with him. Just another thing, evidently that money can buy. Because this, again, I go back to the fact the guy who got hit, the victim, was a very well-paid doctor. I mean, I'm not talking some schlub. We're not talking you or me. We're talking part of that stratosphere.
So you're telling me that this guy invests money of individuals he doesn't get into, I don't know.
He wouldn't take your money.
He wouldn't take a retirement fund from, maybe the district attorney's office?
No.
Public
he doesn't
employees,
do that.
He doesn't do that.
What he does is when, let's say, who's the wealthiest guy we know? Warren Buffett wants somebody to invest his money. Now, Warren Buffett never would. He'd invest his own.
He's got his own investment vehicle.
Well, but when someone very, very wealthy wants to invest their money, they go to him. And he takes care of everything. He's their personal assistant. He's their guy. And as we talked about on the program before, Wall Street is hiring more of these people. There are more of these uber wealthy folks who need someone to handle their financial affairs. That's what this guy does. And I got to wonder who his clientele was. As you've pointed
out,
it's not the attorney's office. It's not the district attorney because they don't make that kind of money. But who is it at the very, very top?
Who perhaps made a call to the right people. See, I mean, it obviously smells of conflict of interest at some level.
No, at every level. There's nowhere that this doesn't stink.
And you know, we talked about this. I've talked to other people, you know, when you recite the Pledge of Allegiance, liberty and justice for all. Unfortunately, that isn't always true.
It's one of those things. One of those things that frustrates me because it does, it's that arrogance, that as the one guy from Reuters pointed out, this invulnerability to anything. And that's what we've done to the banking industry. That's what we've done to the financial industry. They know we're going to bail them out. They know that they've got us by the short hairs. And there's nothing we're going to do about it. And 2008 really solidified that view. When we opened up the checkbook and said, yeah, go ahead, as much as you need. Whatever you need, oh, please just don't crash the economy. And they did anyway. And every time I open the newspaper, every time I look around, CEOs are making more money. The investor class is back and powerful and thrilled to death. Happy days. Happy days on Wall Street. While you and I, who are struggling on Main Street, not so happy. And what we hear from our friends at the Cat Food Commission or the Deficit Commission, well, those folks need tax cuts. You need to see your retirement age go up. You need to see anything that helps you slashed and burned. But these folks are very wealthy, and they're the minions. We need to take care of those folks. I mean, is it they're telling us? By saying, well, we're going to raise Social Security's age, and you've even got Democrats now. Mark Warner came out and said, well, you know, we might have to do that. What are you thinking? This is why I'm telling you. Democrats are just spineless, and I'm afraid they're going to give in on this. I'm afraid they're going to give in. And we're going to see 69, 70. My children will probably see 100. So it works like it used to, that you can collect it, you know, 5 or 6 years after you're dead, you know, like it used to, back in the good old days. Amazing stuff. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. Remember, check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. If you are near your computer, you can watch us online from the website. We use stream all of our programs. Or you can give us a call here, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back with Professor Richard Wolff. Stick around.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. The federal government is facing a lawsuit from the American Civil Liberties Union over a case involving an Air Force sergeant who was honorably discharged after 9 years under the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. A Department of Defense policy guarantees individuals who are discharged honorably after at the least 6 years receive separation pay. However, if an individual is discharged due to homosexuality, that pay is reduced. Former Air Force Staff Sergeant Richard Collins was dismissed under such circumstances and only received half of what he would have received if the honorable discharge would have been under other circumstances. The suit is demanding full pay for those that have been impacted by the Defense Department's policy and could qualify for class action status. According to the ACLU's suit, Collins was outed by two civilians who worked at Cannon Air Force Base. They recognized Collins when he was off duty and off base with his boyfriend. The New York State Department of Labor is investigating a claim that the closed St. Vincent's Hospital in Greenwich Village violated labor laws. Specifically, the hospital could owe laid-off workers a combined $48.8 million for not giving 90 days' notice of mass layoffs, as required under the state's WARN Act. Lawyers for the hospital allege that the state's Department of Health should also be on the hook, as it played a role in the closure of the facility.
Nurses are aghast at what the union calls cruel and senseless cuts to Social Security and Medicare. Michael Leidy is Director of Public Policy for National Nurses United.
It is an attack on the most vulnerable, and it goes in the opposite direction from what we need to do, which is actually shore up Social Security, improve the retirement benefit given the collapse of private sector pensions, and also expand Medicare to include everyone. That's really the only way to permanently stabilize Medicare.
Leidy says there's no doubt that if these proposals are adopted, it'll lead to misery, heartache, and uncertainty for many of the most vulnerable Americans who have paid all their working lives into Social Security and Medicare. He says this represents a redistribution of wealth from working people to Wall Street. The union says it'll mount a vigorous campaign against these deficit commission proposed cuts.
Here's today's economic report. If employment advertising website Monster.com is to be believed, companies seeking new employees is on an upward tick. According to the website, listings calling for workers in the legal industry have increased by 29% since the same time last year. Business and financial careers are also up by 28%. Media careers, which include entertainment, sports, and design, are also seeing an increase in help-wanted postings, 25% since last year. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting by Ulico and the OPEIU.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
You want to see the greenbacks tumble? The story in today's Wall Street Journal. Paychecks for CEOs climb. Joanne Lublin writes, chief executives at the largest U.S. public companies enjoy bigger paydays in their latest fiscal year as share prices recovered and profits soared amid the country's slow emergence from recession. At these 456 companies, the median pre-tax value of CEO salaries, bonuses, and long-term incentives rose by 3%, up to $7.23 million, according to the proxy filings analyzed by the Wall Street Journal. The investors, they did very well as well. And you look at the cat food commission, I mean the debt commission. What they're telling us is, oh, you people at the bottom, tighten your belts, retire later, clean up the mess. Wall Street's back. What about us? I've got Professor Richard Wolff on the line. He's of Capitalism Hits the Fan fame. Professor Wolff, welcome to the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
You know, I look at this stuff. The CEOs are back. Investor class is very happy. Wall Street seems to be popping the corks. But all I keep hearing is, I got to clean up the mess.
Yeah, well, it's a study in obscenity. Not the kind with four-letter words, but the kind in which a country like ours, where the gap between rich and poor got worse and worse and brought on this crisis, is now discovering that the crisis itself has become once again a mechanism for further creating a bigger distance between the rich and the poor. It really is, for those of us that are professional economists, it's kind of astonishing. And let me just give you one example. We have an enormous unemployment, 15 million Americans without a job, another 10 million that have become discouraged and don't even look anymore, another 5 to 10 million that are in part-time work, even though they want and are ready to work full-time. What we need is more jobs. If you actually do what that commission proposed, is push back the retirement date, then there are going to be millions of Americans who, instead of retiring and then making their jobs available for young people and unemployed people, they're going to stay in their jobs longer. All that does is make the unemployment for everybody else worse. It's an astonishing way to try to get an economy at a time when the larger unemployment problem is crowding out everything else.
You know, but my thing is, and I'm looking at this debt commission, I'm going, they're supposed to be dealing with the debt. What does Social Security really have to do with the debt, since there's supposed to be a couple $1 trillion in there that I know they've borrowed and spent, but I'm under the impression, and help me if I'm wrong here, that Social Security is supposed to be almost deficit neutral.
Yeah, everyone is wondering, you know, it's the agenda of these people who want the government to get out of the debt it incurred, a debt that has zoomed in order to bail out this system in crisis, and now they want the mass of people to pay for it, and the Social Security is just thrown in there because if they can push that back, if they can lower the benefits, which they proposed, and postpone giving these lower benefits, which they proposed, that's one more way that the burden of this crisis can be put on the average person. It kind of boggles the mind that you've said to the American people, first we're going to stick it to you with higher unemployment, home foreclosures, and everything else. Then we're going to gross you out by bailing out the richest, biggest banks first and finding it impossible to provide jobs. And now, having borrowed money to bail out the banks, we're going to stick it to you to come up with the money to pay back the people we borrowed to bail out everybody but you. It's extraordinary.
Well, it is extraordinary. What's also extraordinary to me is the story, the line that we've been given about how we got into this crisis, about what caused it. I have people tell me all the time that it's, well, you know, it's the CRA. It's because we gave those poor people loans, those handful of poor people who took on more than they could pay back. They're the reason that the country is in the toilet.
Yeah, it's what in other places is called, the syndrome is called blaming the victim. The fact of the matter is that since 2007 in December, when this recession, this great recession officially began, it has been people at all levels of income who have made the mistake of borrowing what they thought they could pay back. But remember, it was perfectly reasonable in 2004, 5, and 6 when everybody, or nearly everybody, was promising full employment or nearly full employment, rising wages, better benefits, and all the rest, to undertake a borrowing for a house was a reasonable thing to do. Nobody foresaw the level of economic downturn and unemployment that has been produced. So now to blame the people who were not told and not advised that unemployment was coming on this scale, that they should have known that and not taken out a loan in advance of a situation nobody foretold, that's really bizarre. And the proof of the pudding is, for every loan made to a poor person, there's a bank that made the loan. People tend to forget that a loan is a two-way operation. There's the borrower, but there's also the lender. We teach in our business schools that the job of a banker is to be very prudent with the deposits that are placed with him in trust,
right,
and only to make loans that are safe. We now know that they made loans to rich people, poor people, and folks in between, big businesses and little businesses, none of whom they thought were at risk because they thought the economy would not have the kind of collapse we've had. So now that it has had the collapse and the people worst hit by it can't pay their debts, we suddenly find it convenient to blame them when they were under the impression that everybody gave them, the media leading the charge, that no such a collapse of capitalism was in the cards.
You know, I look at this, and you make great points, but the response to that, and I've made those myself, the response I always get is, well, the government made them give the loans.
Yeah, you know, this is, and I hope you bear with me and with my intensity of feeling. As an observer of the American scene all my life, I'm mystified. If you look at the 8 million people added to the unemployment roll since December of 2007 to the time we're speaking right now, 7.5 million out of those 8 million became unemployed in the usual way. Their private capitalist employers fired them. So if you are upset about unemployment, it is very bizarre to leap over the people who actually caused it and to blame politicians. It's a very peculiar way that the American people have. Same thing with a home foreclosure. The lender, typically a bank, goes into court to force you out of your home. If you're upset with foreclosures, The first place to point a finger is at the bankers and the other lenders who push you out of your home. Again, the American people leap over this and decide to get angry at the politician. If I were a businessman or woman, I'd find this very convenient. You stick it to people with unemployment and foreclosure, and instead of getting mad at you, they get mad at politicians, spend a lot of energy getting rid of one group, bring in another group, who then become as angry and upset as everybody else, and don't change anything. And meanwhile, it's always this churning of the government. The government doesn't hire most people, and the government doesn't fire most people. Unemployment is a decision private enterprises undertake in order to guard and preserve their profitability. So if you're not happy with unemployment, you have to look at the mechanism that produces it.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the statistics I had read recently, I think it was the companies who laid people off saw their CEOs saw a 42% increase in their compensation.
You know, it's an amazing thing. The numbers you quoted at the beginning of this segment that the Wall Street Journal announced, you know, if those people had any shame, if those people even had any consciousness of the vulnerability that they are actually facing, they wouldn't have the nerve at a time of national cutbacks when a government commission is talking about cutting Social Security benefits. I want to remind your listeners, the average benefit for a Social Security recipient in this country is $12,000. That's not a whole hell of a lot to live on, let alone to live in a decent way. You're going to cut that now. You're going to make unemployment worse by forcing older people to stay in the job market. You're doing that and at the same time announcing multi-million-dollar payments. Those folks live in a different world. And as that becomes harder and harder for the rest of us to tolerate, it's vulnerable for them. I find it a bizarre disconnect from the way the world works that they can do this, that the newspapers can report it, and act as if it has no consequence for the mass of people. I think that's making a terrible mistake.
I absolutely agree. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Professor Richard Wolff. Capitalism Hits the Fan fame. If you haven't seen it, Google Capitalism Hits the Fan. It's a great presentation and does a nice job of explaining how we got, kind of how we got to where we are today. Professor Wolff, you know, I'm looking at this Tea Party movement, this last election that just happened, and you know, you talked about people being angry at the politicians. Now we see this tea thing rise up. I'm curious what your thoughts are on this.
Well, you know, part of my heart goes out to these people. I share their sense of rage. What we're looking at is not only a system, economic system that's not working, but is forcing the mass of people who've suffered the most through it with unemployment and foreclosures to pick up the pieces and the payment, the costs of bailing out everybody but themselves. It really is too much. It kind of crosses the line of what is tolerable. And so I understand their anger. I understand their upset. I understand their determination to actually become active, which is hard for Americans often to do, in a collective way to make change. All that part I like.
Me too.
But when they come to the point of figuring out what they ought to be doing, who they ought to point the finger at, what kinds of changes they want to make, then, boy, do I fall out with them, because I think they have misunderstood who caused this problem. They've misunderstood the solution. They are going to try to get the government out of our economy. The sad reality is that almost everything that the government does in our economic system, it was called in to do because the private sector didn't work. We have a Food and Drug Administration because the conditions in the medical field, in the food and in the that we depend on, was so bad. The profit hunting by the corporations led to such abuse of us as a people that we called in the government. We have a Federal Reserve because having left the economy to the bankers, we had one crisis after another in the 19th century. It used to be called panics, and that's a good word because it gives you an idea of what the effect of it was. So if suddenly we're deciding that the government should get back out of all the things we called it in to do, well, that would only make sense if there was a shred of evidence that having the government get out leads us to a situation that is better than having the government in. And there isn't nothing like that. Well, I understand the government makes mistakes. I understand the government has its problems. That is true. But the solution of getting the government out is bizarre.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. You know, when I went to some of the first Tea Party rallies and I said, hey, you know, what are we angry about? I'm angry about the bad job market. I'm angry about our insane trade policies. What are we angry about? Oh, yeah, we're angry about that, and it's the government's fault. Tear down the government. I'm like, really?
Yeah. The business people must be laughing all the way to the bank. You know, you stick it to the mass of workers with unemployment. You stick them with the burden of foreclosure. You stick them with the cutbacks in their Social Security. And where do they get angry? At you who's doing it to them? No. At the politician. Nice. And at this absurd game of exchanging Tweedledum for Tweedledee and being surprised when it doesn't make a whole hill of beans difference. It's a strange kind of compulsion, and it's hard for me not to believe that the big businesses, the Koch brothers and those other folks who fund the Tea Party, make it a kind of condition. You know, we'll help you out financially, we'll make you an important political force, but you got to be careful never to point the finger at those of us who provide the money.
Of course.
And that's an unfortunate choice of the Tea Party folks, at least those that go in that direction, not to realize that the hand that may be helping them is also the hand pointing them in a direction that cannot solve the problems they are concerned with.
Because they're the cause of problems.
Right.
I got to take a break here. Can you stick around for a couple minutes? We're going to take a quick break. We're right back with Professor Richard Wolff of Capitalism Hits the Fan fame. Stick around. Right back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Of all the things you'd want the President of the United States to tackle right after November's congressional elections, how high on your list of priorities would you put the task of selling weapons to India? It seems that even the fall tilling of Michelle Obama's White House garden would be a more worthy presidential pursuit than peddling military hardware. November's election didn't go all that well for Obama, and he has a giant to-do list to go through if he's to convince America's workaday majority that he's really working for them. Yet, the weekend after the election, his first move was to fly 8,000 miles away to try to convince the Indian government to buy $5 billion worth of military hardware from Boeing and a mess of other weaponry from Lockheed Martin and other U.S. arms dealers. Screwy priorities aside, however, why the hell is the President of the United States of America playing Willie Loman for corporate arms hawkers? Yeah, I know they claim that the selling of killing machines creates jobs, but is war and death the only product America has to hawk to the world these days? Besides, India requires that a third of the work on the planes, missiles, and other armaments it buys be farmed out to its manufacturers, creating jobs there, not here. One other dicey point. India is stockpiling weaponry as part of its ever-escalating confrontation with its neighbor and bitter rival, Pakistan, a U.S. ally that our arms dealers also supply. How long before American soldiers get caught in this deadly crossfire of U.S.-made weapons? This is Jim Hightower saying, pretensions aside, Obama's trip to India is not about jobs, but about fattening the bottom line of war profiteers. The arms trade is immoral. It fuels perpetual war, and the President of the United States ought not be its traveling salesman.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go With the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Well, that's what they're doing. They're taking a whole bunch of the money. And I look at this guy who's the CEO of Occidental Petroleum, 2009, during the height of the recession, if you will, $52.2 million. And we can't ask him to maybe pay a little bit higher in taxes. Or, hey, just like Tom Corbett here, our governor-elect said, you know, maybe we won't call it taxes. We'll just ask for more contributions. Simple stuff. I've got Professor Richard Wolf on the phone with me. Capitalism Hits the Fan fame. Professor Wolf, I appreciate you sticking around for me.
Oh, I'm glad to do it. These are important things to get out in the public conversation.
You know, I've been looking at this debt commission, basically the austerity programs that we're already beginning about talking, slashing Social Security, slashing Medicare, slashing social programs, and I look at the rest of the world. The rest of the world, they're in the streets. I look at the UK, I look at France. People are taken to the streets. Why aren't we seeing that here?
Well, that's a really fascinating question because, as you correctly put it, and I might mention November 24th, the day before Thanksgiving, the people of Portugal have declared they will go out on a general strike. Nothing will move, nothing will happen. To show the anger of working people and the demand for a completely different change and how they're going, and an end to what they there call austerity, which is just the European word for making the mass of people pick up the tab for bailing out the corporations that brought us this crisis. Everyone wonders that. It's sort of the $64,000 question. They're going into the streets. They're challenging their governments. They are making their voices felt. What is it here in the United States? And I've really racked my brain, and here's the best I can do. In those countries, we have not seen over the last 30 years anything like the decline in the trade union movement, in all kinds of people's organizations, community organizations. They've had their problems, they've had a decline, but nothing like what we've had here. So that when something finally can unite all the different groups that are critical and want some progressive change, they're able to come together. They know each other. They have experience working together. The linkages among people are vibrant, even when they disagree. And so they can mount these demonstrations. Give you an example. The French, six times from the 7th of September to today, have gotten out over 1 million people into the streets. France has one-fifth the population of the United States. An equivalent outpouring in this country would see 5 million people in the streets. We've never had that, I believe, in our country's history on anything.
Nope.
Those people came out to let the government know that there would be an immense outpouring. Mr. Sarkozy, the president of France, now has polling numbers lower than those of George Bush in the last 4 months of his presidency, which were unprecedentedly low. I mean, this is a government that has now been effectively isolated by a majority of its people. The public opinion polls support these demonstrations by upwards of 68% to 69% of the people. You know, it is a society that's going to have to make accommodations with this overwhelming majority opinion. And they can do it because they have these organizations that have a history and an experience with one another. We don't have them. We're, in a sense, behind them. The issues are the same. But we have to commence almost from scratch, not quite, but almost, to rebuild the kind of organizations that can get people together, can make the claims, make the arguments that people will rally to. I'm convinced. I do a lot of public speaking. I know that the American people are upset without wanting to go the Tea Party route, to go in a different way to express their upsets with what's going on. But they lack a kind of coordinated, organized leadership to rally around. That's what's needed, and that's what the difference is between us and the Europeans.
Yeah, I agree. You know, one of the things that I said when this whole thing happened in September of 2008, I said, hopefully this thing gets bad enough to where people start to feel hungry and their heads get right. Because I do believe that before anything changes, people have to suffer a little bit.
Yeah, the suffering is now... is really deep. You know, it's not just that we have huge unemployment. It's also that our unemployed are unemployed for longer periods of time than has been the case in a long while. We are throwing millions of people out of their homes. You know, the costs of this kind of an economic downturn are calculated in decades. You know, we have enormous numbers of people suffering mental trauma, physical trauma, interrupting or altogether ending their educations. That deprives this country of all kinds of people and productivity. We will all be paying the price. It is not a rational society that allows simultaneously millions of people to be without work who want to work. And the government announces what we have is a 70% capacity utilization. What that means is that about 30% of the tools, equipment, machines, office space, store space is sitting idle, dusty and rusting, instead of being used. So we have people who want to work. We have the raw materials, tools, and equipment for them to work on. And this system can't get them together, thereby depriving all the rest of us of the wealth that could be produced if those people had the jobs they want, which would give them the dignity, the ability to pay for their mortgages and everything else. This is a crazy system that is not working right. And yelling at politicians is not the solution.
I agree. You know, let me ask you this, because the Republicans ran on a platform that, you know, regulation certainty, there would be no new regulations, that tax cuts for businesses would flow, that then once they had this certainty, once they had this credit, they had this money, businesses would then start to hire at an enormous pace. And we see reports that they're sitting on upwards of $2 trillion in money that we've guaranteed and handed out. Is there some rational thought behind this, or is it just a bunch of wish and hope?
No, I think it's an ideology. It's an ideology that whatever the problem is, the solution is to make businesses more profitable, as if doing that guarantees the outcome. Let me give you an example of how that failed. In the aftermath of the collapse of Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers in the second half of 2008, the government, then of George Bush, but subsequently more or less the same by Obama, poured literally trillions of dollars into the banking sector. The hope was to get the economy going again, because the banks, it was thought, by becoming recipients of this enormous government money, would then resume the lending that we hoped would get the economy going again, lending to people to buy stuff, and lending to businesses to make that stuff. It didn't work out. The banks said, we're not lending to anybody because this is a lousy economy. So many people are becoming unemployed that the customer base of our society is atrophying. And so we're not going to lend money to companies because those companies are not facing customers. And we're not going to lend to individuals because without work, they're having more and more difficulty. They're not, you know, worth the risk of lending to. So the bottom line was that all the money given to the banks was basically held by the banks to improve their security, yep, to build up their reserves, and the rest of us are sitting, you know, scratching our foreheads because the plan didn't work. It made the banks more profitable, and they started playing in the stock market, so it went up. They all did fine, but the claim that helping them would be the royal road to helping the rest of us, that didn't work. That's another one of those old trickle-down hypotheses that proves not to work. And okay, if they really believed it, we now have the proof it didn't work. Don't commit the same mistake again.
Yeah, it's the same thing over again. Well, let me ask you this. Ben Bernanke, the Fed chair, came out with this new idea. Well, not new. He's done it once before. They're going to put $600 billion back into the economy. They call it quantitative easing. I'm curious what your thoughts on that are.
Well, basically, you know, calling it quantitative easing is a little bit like playing a game with words. This is what used to be called and should be understood by everybody as printing money. Basically, the Federal Reserve is the agency in our society that is entitled to create money. They literally can order the printing of money, or they can order that banks are given a cash account at the Federal Reserve, which is the equivalent of printing money. So what they've decided to do is to boost the American economy by flooding us, having already done it once, with another $600 billion worth of purchasing power. And again, here's the plan. You flood it first and foremost into the banks. That's where it'll start. And then the hypothesis is, hopefully, maybe, cross your fingers, the banks will lend it out to everybody. But the banks are already saying, we're not going to do it, because this is not an economy where it is profitable for us to lend, neither to individuals nor to many, many businesses, particularly medium and small ones, because it's too risky and there's not enough money in it. So we're going to sit on the money, or, and here's the more scary part, we're going to buy treasury bonds. We're actually going to lend it to the United States government. When that happens, then what you've got is one branch of the government, the Federal Reserve, printing money and lending it to another branch of the government, the U.S. Treasury, that's out there borrowing. And this is not anything other than a simple sleight of hand. This is a government having lost every other way of trying to boost the economy is down to the age-old game of literally printing money. And that's why you saw such anger around the world. All the people around the world and the governments that own dollars worth of investments are afraid that what this is doing is basically collapsing the value of the dollar and hence of the wealth they own in the form of dollars. And they're not happy, and they're not going to allow that to happen. They're not going to allow the United States to bail itself out at their expense. And how they retaliate is going to shape what happens in the world. You know, we're in a situation where you hear now the phrase currency war and the war among the different countries as they try desperately to get out of a crisis and are beginning to do so at each other's expense. That's scary enough. But when you remember history, you also have to remember that currency wars and trade wars have not infrequently been the first steps of something that ends up as a military war.
Exactly. And you're already hearing a lot of countries saying, we want to move away from the dollar as the reserve
currency.
Absolutely.
They've been burnt. They're not, you know, they were told, accumulate the dollar, it's good as gold, America's the strongest capitalist country. They're seeing a very different situation, a desperate country, now resorting to literally the printing press to try to get itself out of a hole that is becoming politically untenable. And they're wondering what extremes the United States will go to, and they don't want to be the victims of whatever the United States does to fix its own problems, and they don't want to be caught holding the investments in a country that is looking to them to be on a downward decline and unable to play the economic role in the future that it did in the past.
Right. Let me go back for a second. You said the Federal Reserve was an arm of the government. It's my understanding the Federal Reserve is a private corporation.
Well, you got to be careful. It's private, and it is. The chairman of the Federal Reserve is appointed by the President of the United States. He's not appointed by the shareholders in a company or something like that. It is a very peculiar institution in the sense that it is partly governmental and partly a creature of private banks. It's supposed to be independent of the government, but it isn't altogether. It's supposed to be independent of the private banking sector, but it isn't really altogether. It's kind of a patchwork compromise that is charged with the unbelievably important task of determining basically how much money is circulating in our economy, which affects everything else. So the power is enormous, and because they're in this peculiar status, they make their decisions without being accountable. If they decide, for example, to increase the money supply, they don't have to get the approval of the president. They don't have to get the approval of Congress or the Supreme Court or anybody else. It's an extraordinary power that they wield. And since the banks are so powerful in it, they tend to do the kinds of things that bankers want you to do when things are not going so well, which is why they spent their overwhelming energy on bailing out the banking sector under the false assumption that by fixing banks, you'd fix everything else. What we have here is a little over a year, that banks have done reasonably well, and what banks are willing to invest in, which is the stock market to a degree, has done pretty well, but the basic economy that the vast majority of us rely on hasn't done better at all, and yet they want to continue. And that's why it's so tragic that the Federal Reserve is doing this, because it's really more of the same. And the argument that the only thing we need is more of the same when the first step didn't work is a questionable, I'm being polite here,
yep,
is a questionable way of proceeding.
At best. Last question I've got for you. Where do we go from here? I'm looking at this and I keep seeing the same trickle down, hand money to the very wealthy in the hopes that maybe they'll bestow a rain of honey upon us, like a nice yellow substance upon us that isn't what we've gotten in the past. Where do we go from here?
Well, I think there's two or three things that I would conclude and leave with your listeners to chew on. First is one that is a simple borrowing from the past of the United States. In 1934, when unemployment was terrible, we're not that far gone yet, but we're getting there. Roosevelt, the then president, goes on the radio and he says to the American people, look, we've waited now several years for the private sector to come up and hire people. It's either unable or unwilling to do it. And We cannot have millions of people unemployed, unused capacity and raw material. We can't do it. So the government's going to have to hire these people and put them to work doing something useful. From 1934 to 41, Roosevelt hired 11 million Americans. It's an astonishing story. It put those people to work. It gave them a sense of that they were important people. It gave them a decent income. They could maintain their mortgage payments. They could buy stuff. That gave other Americans work. God almighty, you have to ask yourself, at a time like this, why in the world would the United States Congress not be debating some kind of program that goes to where the problem is at its base, in jobs, in incomes, and provide jobs to rebuild our central cities, to produce proper care for our kids and our elderly, and all the other things we need done. So my first reaction is, why in the world not learn from our own history of a comparable time when that program, whatever its limits, at least put millions of people to work and was more successful as an antidote to the Great Depression than anything else the government then did. The second thing I would say is we need a national conversation. Look, we used to say that our economic system, capitalism, was a great system because, quote unquote, it delivered the goods. And for a good bit of period of our history, it did. I'll admit that. But it doesn't now. It's not delivering the goods. It's delivering a growing gap between rich and poor. It's delivering foreclosure and unemployment. It's telling us that we're going to have to postpone and get reduced Social Security when we're elderly. It's quarreling with us about Medicare's expansions to meet our needs. It's not a capitalism that's delivering the goods. And the question that I would ask people to raise and talk about is, can we do better than capitalism? Has capitalism no longer been able to work in the way that we want it to? And we've lived for 40 years under a kind of taboo that you can't ask that question. You dare not. You're not being loyal. We have to get over that. That's childish. An economic system is not something sacrosanct. It's something that has to be interrogated to ask whether it's doing what we need to have it do to live the kind of society, to be together in a community in the way that we want. And for me, what that means is to question how we organize production. Let me end with that. Suppose we took our democracy seriously and we said that every enterprise that produces the goods and services that does the work should be run by the people who work there, all of them, democratically, together. Not a few people on a board of directors and a few big shareholders, but all the people who have to live in that factory or in that office, who have to live with the consequences. Suppose in the 1970s, when the wages stopped rising in America, that workers had run the factories. They wouldn't have stopped raising their wages. If the workers together ran the factories and the offices, they wouldn't be moving their jobs to China or India or anywhere else. We'd have a completely different society that was run by the people, for the people, and not a system of profit, which we tolerated when it, quote-unquote, delivered the goods. But we have to question now that it isn't doing that anymore.
You know, I look at what's going on in Argentina. In fact, you know, right after 9/11, the hot money left Argentina, left it to collapse. And you saw just what you're saying. You saw the working people come together. They started those factories back up. They figured out how to get the raw materials they needed. And as soon as everything was back running, the owner class, the investor class, they wanted it back.
Absolutely. It was amazing. They closed the factories. They left the country, took their wealth with them, made fun of the effort of the workers to open the factories again and get them running. But when the workers did it and did it successfully, you're absolutely right, they were suddenly coming back, realizing not just that they wanted their wealth back, but being even more terrified by what had been proven in Argentina, which is that the workers don't need the shareholders and the workers don't need the bosses, that they can themselves own and operate these factories. What they were afraid of was the model that it suggests in the rest of the world, that there are other ways of organizing the work of production that we all spend our adult lives involved in, that we can do it differently, and we ought to be debating in our society. I'm not claiming I know the answer, but we ought to be debating these different ways of organizing society so that we're not stuck in an economic system that keeps telling us we have to have this level of unemployment, this level of cutbacks of our future, this level of limited opportunities for our children. at a certain point, you have to stand up or else you've become a kind of passive mouse that allows anything to happen because you're too afraid to stand up and ask the questions that you know are the ones that need to be answered.
Yep. Excellent point, Professor Wolf. I appreciate your time. Excellent conversation, great information, and I look forward to having you back again soon.
I'd love to do it, and my hat's off to you for having the courage to raise these questions and help people to pose and answer these questions, because our society depends on it.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
You too.
Again, Professor Richard Wolf. Check out Capitalism Hits the Fan. It is a great little lecture. It's about 50 minutes long, well worth it. It goes through and really explains how we got to this point with the wage structure. With instead of giving us wage increases, what we got were credit cards. And, you know, Jake, one of the things I liked about the conversation I had with Professor Wolf is something I've been saying all along. The federal government has got to be, they've got to become the employer of last resort. You can't have all of these folks sitting idle just waiting for a check to come. I've always said that.
You know, and the Republicans are doing exactly what he condemned. And he said it right. There's a true blind allegiance to ideology. In spite of everything, what we should hold sacred is the future of this country and its people, not a particular economic or philosophical or political ideology. And that's exactly what the Republican Party is doing. To me, they are selling out the future of this country.
You know, more tax cuts, more deregulation, more of the same. And, I'm worried that we're going to end up in the same boat, only worse, as we move forward. That, again, we're going to keep giving to the very top. And the rest of us, well, we're the ones cleaning up the mess again.
And something that is so true when you think about it, when he said it, I thought, wow, he's right on. What he said was, isn't it amazing that they blame the government and those in power right now? And they kind of blindly either aren't aware of it or they forgive the capitalists who are running our businesses. They are the ones that made decisions. They are the ones that made the decisions to take jobs overseas. They are the ones that laid off our workers. But yet the easy answer is, and I think the Republicans are going to reap the whirlwind because of it, the easy answer is, well, it's those in government's fault. Well, that's not really true.
No, it's not true at all. I mean, the interesting part of this is that we're continuing just to rehash the same failed ideology. And when you look at the Grand Pledge, when you look at the Great Pledge, all they're talking about is more of the same. More of the same. Let's take a quick break right here. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this.
For and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show. The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. The federal government is facing a lawsuit from the American Civil Liberties Union over a case involving an Air Force sergeant who was honorably discharged after 9 years under the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. A Department of Defense policy guarantees individuals who are discharged honorably after at the least 6 years receive separation pay. However, if an individual is discharged due to homosexuality, that pay is reduced. Former Air Force Staff Sergeant Richard Collins was dismissed under such circumstances and only received half of what he would have received if the honorable discharge would have been under other circumstances. The suit is demanding full pay for those that have been impacted by the Defense Department's policy and could qualify for class action status. According to the ACLU's suit, Collins was outed by two civilians who worked at Kennan Air Force Base. They recognized Collins when he was off duty and off base with his boyfriend. The New York State Department of Labor is investigating a claim that the closed St. Vincent's Hospital in Greenwich Village violated labor laws. Specifically, the hospital could owe laid-off workers a combined $48.8 million for not giving 90 days' notice of mass layoffs, as required under the state's WIN Act. Lawyers for the hospital allege that the state's Department of Health should also be on the hook, as it played a role in the closure of the facility.
Nurses are aghast at what the union calls cruel and senseless cuts to Social Security and Medicare. Michael Leidy is Director of Public Policy for National Nurses United.
It is an attack on the most vulnerable, and it goes in the opposite direction from what we need to do, which is actually shore up Social Security, improve the retirement benefit given the collapse of private sector pensions, and also expand Medicare to include everyone. That's really the only way to permanently stabilize Medicare.
Leidy says there's no doubt that if these proposals are adopted, it'll lead to misery, heartache, and uncertainty for many of the most vulnerable Americans, who have paid all their working lives into Social Security and Medicare. He says this represents a redistribution of wealth from working people to Wall Street. The union says it'll mount a vigorous campaign against these deficit commission proposed cuts.
Here's today's economic report. If employment advertising website Monster.com is to be believed, companies seeking new employees is on an upward tick. According to the website, listings calling for workers in the legal industry have increased by 29% since the same time last year. Business and financial careers are also up by 28%. Media careers, which include entertainment, sports, and design, are also seeing an increase in help-wanted postings, 25% since last year. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting by Ulico and the OPEIU.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Right now. That's right, right now. I don't know if you saw the news today. Charlie Rangel walked out of the hearing room. Said, what you got to love about this, and you got to love the guy.
He's got moxie.
He's got stones. He says that his family's caught H.E. double hockey stick for the last 2.5 years because of this investigation, and that he's not going to go into the hearing room again without an attorney, that he's already spent $2 million, and it could cost another $1 million in attorney fees, and he's not going back in. He says, quote, I'm being denied the right to have a lawyer right now because I don't have the opportunity to set up a legal defense fund. I mean, really? Again, you know, it's these folks who, for some odd reason, they think that they're better. And look, he's a Democrat, and I'm going to bash him just like I would anybody else who does the things that he did.
And the truth is, he's not going to be removed by his constituents. He's just not. He's in one of these districts where he has overwhelming support.
Yep, because he brings home the bacon. He takes care of his constituency. But at the end of the day, you got to have rules. Mm-hmm. And I love the fact that, you know, again, you love the fact where he goes, you know, I don't have time to set up a legal defense fund. So, you know, I'm looking at this and I'm going, do you really want to hold this off until the Republicans take over and then get to use you as the centerpiece of their attack? I mean, that's really what this is going to be. This is going to be their centerpiece. He is going to be that crowning jewel.
He is not going to go softly into the night, is he?
I think he's too stupid to. I mean, really, this is going to destroy any momentum the Democrats could have, because they're going to always keep throwing it back up. And the Democrats on a certain level are going to feel the need to try and defend him. And I'm not defending him. What he did was wrong. And here are the allegations. He took a house. There's a ban on gifts and stuff for House members. So he took a bunch of money. He sent out a bunch of requests on official letterhead that he used to fund his little Charles B. Rangel Center for Public Service at the City College of New York. That's a violation. Can't do that. And you know what the part of it was that gets me is he was sending it to these charities who had business before before Congress, including the Ways and Means Committee that he was sitting on. The other part of this is a U.S. government code of ethics. Several allegations fall under this code, among them accepting favors, donations to the Rangel Center, obviously, that could be construed as influencing Rangel's congressional duties. Acceptance of a rent-subsidied New York apartment for a campaign office when the lease said it was for residential use only. And a failure to report that as taxable income. Look, this is stuff that would get us into trouble. And he didn't report $600,000 until later. And he was late with that. So, you know, look, you're going to have to stand trial one way or another.
And I would bet, I don't know about each particular charge, but I would bet some of those charges he probably did from time to time and got away with it. And
yep.
Somebody caught him this time.
It's like all of it. They get away with a little bit, and then they get caught. Let's go to the phones. Got Mike on line one. How are we doing today, Mike?
Hey, Rick, how is it?
It's good. I'm good.
Hey, I was listening to the good doctor. It's always good to hear that my analysis is accurate, and he confirmed it.
Well, I think we're all of the same mindset. I'm just not as deep as maybe as you are. I don't think that the end is near. I do think we're gonna get out of this at some point.
Well, I don't know. I mean, when I see the Fed start to print $1 trillion in cash, that's going to devalue our currency by 20%. I don't see where we're going to get out of this. I really don't. I worry about the safety net. The only reason that we're not in worse shape than the Great Depression is the safety net.
Which they want to destroy.
And it's already destroyed. It's empty. There's no money left. Pennsylvania doesn't have a dime left right now to pay unemployment benefits to anybody. And how they do it, I don't know. I don't know whether, you know, maybe they got a printing press there too in labor and industry. But it's broke. It owes the federal government $2 billion plus. So by definition, it's broke. That safety net's gone. And if that safety net fails in this society, it's going to be far uglier than it was in the 20s. Because people today are not going to be inclined to stand in line for hours to get a bowl of soup and a piece of bread.
No, that I will agree with you on. But there's part of me that says the wealth class won't allow that to happen. Because they know, and as you've pointed out in the past, they know they can't hire enough guards and build walls high enough to protect them.
Yeah, but they have jet airplanes today. They just leave the country.
Yeah, but if we're doing what you're saying we're doing, and there's part of me that says, you know, if you're printing this money, you're going to collapse not only our economy, but the global economy. They're not going to be safe there either.
Well, I mean, we'll see. I mean, I think there's a fairly good possibility that, as the good doctor said, that our current economic policies are going to bring us into a shooting war with somebody, if not the rest of the world, because they don't want to hear from the robber barons on Wall Street, fooled you, you know, buyer beware, caveat emptor. You don't tell people with nuclear missiles things like that.
No, I agree.
And that's what we're doing. And just the overall economic effect of China and a couple other countries saying, we're done with your bonds and we're going to start selling them on the market for whatever we can get for them is coup de grace for us economically.
Yep, we'll see how this plays out. I'm not saying that I know the answers, but I know that I'm not thrilled with it.
You know, I wish we could get somebody, and maybe you know somebody who could come on and talk about it, to give us a fairly detailed analysis of some way out, some reasonable process wherein, you know, I mean, I used to be a chess player, and I don't see any way that this ain't checkmate.
I do know some very... very learned individuals on this topic, and I will in the coming weeks I will find a couple of them.
Because I mean, I would love to hear somebody give me a reasonable, positive option that we could follow that will get us out of this.
You have given me a challenge, Mike, and I will live up to that challenge.
I don't know if it's a challenge, but God, I could use some good news, Rick.
And that's what we're going to do.
Okay.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
You know, that, I do. I know a couple of people, and a couple of names popped into my head, and we're gonna go try and hunt those folks down. Because there's gotta be a way out of this that doesn't involve, missiles flying. At least I hope.
Part of you looks at what Mike says, and one even hates to admit it to themselves, and maybe that's the problem with you and I. We hate to admit that perhaps we're going to reach a point where it's hopeless. If it goes on too long, Mike's scenario could come to pass. That's why we're here. We're hoping to cut that off. We're hoping that America comes to its senses. And for that to happen, the American people are going to have to wake up. And so far, I haven't seen it.
Yeah, and I'm hoping there'll be some organizing. That's why we're here, to begin that process, to have these conversations, because I think they're important. I thought, you know, Dr. Wolf's piece on Capitalism Hits the Fan is a fantastic piece, well worth the watch. So I would Google that and look for that. Republican Senator John Ensign from Nevada. Remember, he voted against the health care bill? Remember that? He's also one of those guys out there on the crusade against earmarks. Just today broke that he got a $960,000 earmark for the University of Nevada for a primary care residence expansion program. So
imagine that. Imagine that, a Republican breaking his promise. Oh, let me sit down. I'm shocked.
So it's not bad enough that you're against a health care bill, but you're also against earmarks, and you're using government money to fund a private institution. You kind of got to wonder about that. You kind of got to wonder. Also, Chuck Grassley, you remember him? He's taking credit now for the improvements to Medicare, even though, you know, because there were a bunch of improvements made to Medicare through the Affordable Care Act, even though he, again, himself, voted against the law as well. So another one of those guys twisting himself, you know, twisting his arm, patting himself on the back when he opposed it.
That health care, that whole health care debate, and down through his career, he's been known as kind of a centrist conservative, but boy, he went so far to the right. I mean, he just went off the deep end, and now, another Republican.
And speaking of earmarks.
Less than honest.
And speaking of earmarks, I remember last week I said that Mitch McConnell, who will probably be the Senate majority leader, he said he was not going to ban earmarks, you know, because it's how we do business and, you know, we don't want to do that. Well, now he's kind of flipped again. He says he's going to put a moratorium on earmarks. So, you know, who knows?
That could be, he needs the votes to become, you know, a leader in a party. I'm sure that's what that's about.
So they're just going to call it something else. It won't be earmarks anymore. It'll be something else.
It'll be interesting. We ought to take bets how long it's going to take for the Republicans to kind of have a quasi change.
Yeah, they're just going to call it something else.
They'll call it something
else. Kind of like Corbett did it. It wasn't, I'm not breaking my tax pledge. I'm just going to ask people to contribute more. And yes, for you, those who are listening, for the next 4 years, I'm going to remind you of that early and often because I think it's important. Because his little, I'm never ever going to raise fees, never ever going to raise taxes, he can't do it. We're going to take a quick break right here. We're back with Barry Fox, president and owner of the Marble King USA. We're right back after this.
Can make America better. The Rick Smith Show. Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. It is Manufacturing Monday, and on every Monday, we like to take a look at what's going on around the country. How do we revive manufacturing? How do we bring back those good-paying union jobs that used to support a family, like most of the kids I knew growing up through high school that their parents worked in the GM plant and all the feeder plants, all the small shops around. How do we reinvigorate that? I've got Barry Fox on the phone. She is president of Marble King, one of the last remaining marble manufacturers in the U.S. You may have seen her as a guest on the Colbert Report talking about manufacturing. Ms. Fox, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Rick.
You know, I got to be honest. The first thing I heard, I didn't realize there were any marble manufacturers left in the U.S. I thought they'd been all decimated along with the clothing industry.
Not yet, and let's hope that doesn't happen.
How many marble manufacturers were there, say, 10, 20 years ago?
Oh, there were probably about 20, 25. I mean, back in the heyday of marbles, there were as many as 200, 300 factories. There were several in West Virginia alone. But as, you know, foreign imports have continued to take a sizable sum of our market, you know, they've continued to drop off.
You know, we keep hearing people talk about, well, how can we help manufacturing? How can we help small business? And I've been very clear in my opinion that I do believe we need rational trade policies and even some trade barriers that level the playing field on environmental issues, labor issues, and let companies actually compete on a level playing field.
I totally agree, and I think every manufacturer in America agrees wholeheartedly. No one is opposed to globalization, and no one is opposed to us being able to trade with different countries, and certainly with the IT world we all live in, you know, everybody can talk to anybody at any given time via the internet and order as well. Nobody's opposed to the globalization of trade. What we're opposed to is free trade as opposed to fair trade. It needs to be fair, and you're right, the playing field definitely needs to be leveled.
Well, let's talk about your industry, your business from here. Over the last 10 years, how have things gone for you?
Well, I think the same as they've gone, like in America as general. As you see the manufacturing jobs in America decline, you also see that we've lost the very backbone of our economy. And at the same time, you've seen the places those jobs have either been outsourced or just simply gone to, China, India, Brazil, and you've seen their economies rise and their prosperity grow. So I think it doesn't take a rocket scientist to link those two together and say, gee, what is America not doing and what are they doing and where are those jobs located? They're located in manufacturing.
Absolutely, I agree. You know, what I hear from some politicians and some pundits is the reason we can't keep manufacturing jobs here in the U.S. is we're too heavily regulated. We have too many environmental laws, and it's such a high-tax nation. I'm curious from your perspective as a business owner, where you would put those in importance.
Well, I think that those are all important, but I think, too, as Americans, we got to live here. And I think that some of the environmental regulations are good ones, and, you know, they serve a purpose so that we breathe clean air, you know, both us, our children, our grandchildren. I think some of those things are needed. I think with everything, you know, there needs to be balance, and it brings you back to that fairness. When you level a playing field, you need to level it all the way across. What's reasonable? What's acceptable? What is truly detrimental? I mean, I think those things all need to be determined.
Would you hire more employees if you had a tax cut?
I would hire more employees if I had a tax cut, and if they offered the incentives to American companies that they currently offered offshore, you know, jobs, certainly. I think that would be a benefit, and it would be a thank you, in addition, you know, for employing people for more than 75 years, you know, in this country and maintaining not only the workforce and the environment, but how it feeds the small communities, how it feeds our local school systems. Once these manufacturing jobs are gone, where's that tax base going to come from?
Yeah, I agree. One of the premises that I've founded most of my opinions on when it comes to tax cuts, that if we were to give small businesses these tax cuts, I don't think it would create many jobs. I think what we need is we need demand. We need people to have, you know, money in their pocket to buy these products. And also, you know, as we've already talked about, a level playing field to where the prices that I'm paying for American-made marbles and Chinese-made marbles are similar.
I agree, totally agree. But I also think that you need to take it a step further, and I think that maybe in when you said tax incentives or you're talking about what could restore American manufacturing, there is new technology out there that would help all of us as manufacturers become more effective and more efficient in the workplace. We could, like in our industry alone, we could actually probably utilize a third of the energy that it currently takes us to manufacture a product, but that new technology isn't cheap. And certainly with the things that have occurred lately in the banking industry, capital is not there. And so if you would take, you know, give them incentives, you know, like let's say we'll take this much of each dollar and we'll put it into manufacturers that are being successful, that are operating, you know, and have been here and can show that they can be sustained, you know, and let's move forward with that.
Yeah, I agree. You know, one of the things that I keep hearing, everyone keeps talking about manufacturing, everyone keeps talking about small business. The question is, how do we get there? I mean, I keep hearing politicians all the time saying, well, we need to shore up the small businesses. I mean, we need to bring manufacturing back, but yet we still preach for these bizarre free trade agreements like the one that the president's going around talking about in South Korea right now.
And, you know, you can't have free trade if you're going to have fair trade unless you take it a step further and you balance that with currency regulations like what's going on in China, you know, the fact that they can adjust their currency at any given time. I mean, it needs to be fair all the way across the board. Everybody needs to come to the table. We all need to play fair. And, you know, just go back to the golden rule, which we were all taught as children, which is do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. And I'm sure they wouldn't like it much if we adjusted our currency, you know, whenever we felt like it. And so I just feel that that's important. I think that it needs to be fair. And what can we do? I think that one of the things that we can do, and I'll use this analogy, it's sort of like we're all in the car, somebody put in an address, and we've got our GPS set. And we realize when we get almost to the destination or sort of close that the path we're taking is really not the best one because we're familiar with the area, so we know a better way to get there. And instead, we have a choice. We can either stay on that path that GPS is directing us or we can get off the exit and go a better way. I mean, I think we do have that choice, and I think that if we all come together and we act as a unified group, both Republicans, Democrats from a political perspective, manufacturers as a whole, labor, you know, all of us together, and we formulate something that can work, and I think it can.
And I think it starts in Washington because I do believe it's the policies that have really, really messed up this country. And, you know, we hear a lot of talk about the budget deficits. To me, if we could balance our trade deficits, I don't think we would have a problem with our budget deficits.
No, I don't think we would either. I mean, there have to be jobs. And, you know, and if you take a look at the Second World War, one of the things that made America as strong as she was is the fact that we had a manufacturing base and we were self-sustaining. We could make anything we needed right here. We didn't have to ask somebody for it. We didn't have to wait 30 to 45 days for it to be shipped from across the ocean. We could make it right here, and we did.
Yeah, and that's the thing that gets me because, you know, I've been preaching that for the longest time, that, you know, during the war we had the productive capacity to outproduce anybody, and we've lost that. You know, I talk about, you know, every once in a while I go over to Trenton, New Jersey, and there's a bridge that says Trenton makes, the world takes, but not anymore. I'm struggling with the idea of why our leaders haven't figured this out, other than the fact that the very big transnational corporations, the ones who used to make products here but now make them in China and bring them back here to sell as American products, are making wild amounts of money.
And I agree. And I'll tell you another thing that really concerns me, honestly, Rick, is that if the projections are correct, in 2011, America, for the first time since she became a country, is going to import more goods than we manufacture here.
Yep.
I mean, the deficits, you know, are originally going to swing. I mean, you know, that table's going to definitely swing, and it's going to be totally out of balance. And then how long, if that doesn't wake us up, how long will it be before we make nothing here?
Yeah, I've always said, you know, you can only sustain an economy where I'll cut your grass and you cut my hair, or, you know, let me wash your car and you wash my windows for so long.
Well, absolutely. And where are people going to work? Where are they going to be employed? In the banking industry? I don't think so. I mean, banking isn't for everybody. You know, it's for some people. But the workers that we have are skilled laborers. They've worked very hard to perfect their skills and their trades, and they do it better than anybody in the world. And for them not to continue to have those opportunities would certainly be a very sad thing.
Well, let me ask you this, Barry, because, you know, I hear this argument from my conservative friends who love to, you know, tout the wonders of free trade. And I have to ask, how much business do you do in China? I mean, are you doing much exporting there, or are most of your customers here?
No, we don't do any exporting to China, none. We do exporting to other countries in Europe, and we probably have shipped overseas, I would say, to probably 17 different countries. We actually won an award presented by Governor Manchin for excellence in exporting. That being said, there is not an even playing field because when they import our product, there are tariffs on them. So they're actually paying more to import our products than someone in the United States would pay to buy them.
Yeah, because generally they've got value-added taxes.
That's exactly right.
Which is what I've advocated for us to do.
Exactly. And but coming this way, there's nothing. I mean, on the products that we manufacture, there are zero tariffs, and I mean zero, nothing.
Yeah, because I always wonder, you know, why is it that we're happy to let everybody else eat our lunch? Sure,
but
come
yeah,
on,
yeah.
Bring it on in.
Well, you
come
know,
on.
Exactly. Why are we doing that? I mean, you know, I guess that someone's point of view may be that, you know, it's sort of like, you know, the free toy in a McDonald's Happy Meal, although I feel that those are now American jobs that they're giving away, and that, you know, shouldn't be the way it is, for sure.
Well, like I've always said, we're trading good-paying union jobs, good family-sustaining jobs for cheap toasters, and those toasters aren't cheap anymore.
No, they're not, and certainly once they corner the market and the American manufacturers are gone, you know, then they set the price. Yeah. And do you think that's going to continue to be low? I don't think so.
No, not at
all. Not if you're the only market in town.
Well, let me ask you this, Barry Fox, last thing before we wrap this up. As president of Marble King, what should we be doing? What should our listeners be doing to make sure that you get the help that you need to stay in business? Because I got to tell you, I'd hate to see you guys go out of business. I'm gonna buy my kids marbles now because.
Way to go! That's good. That's the first step. Everybody, get on the website, order marbles. That'll be good. But seriously, Rick, I mean, one of the things that they can do is realize that the focus is that this is still America, and it's a country for the people, by the people, and that people can make a difference. They truly can. And I think that if they, you know, get on, like, AmericanManufacturing.org, and there's form letters in there that you can write to your senator, your Congress, you know, and then we follow that up as manufacturers, you know, with, hey, these are the jobs, this is the potential loss, and we've got to do something to change this, I think it's going to matter.
I sure hope so. And as consumers, we've got to go to the shop and we've got to go to the store and go, hey, you know, this is an American-made product. We need to support them for being here.
Absolutely.
Which I will be doing here very shortly, buying my kids their first set of marbles.
All right. That's great, Rick. Thank you.
Going to buy the kids the first set of marbles. Of course, the website, MarbleKingUSA.com. Barry, please stick around for a minute. We're going to take a quick break and come back, and we'll pick this conversation up on the other side of the break. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to
making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Hello, I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME, Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. Right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are, not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing. So is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. We're here with Barry Fox, president of Marble King. Their website, MarbleKingUSA.com. Lots of good things there. But here, you know, here's the thing. As we've been involved in Iraq, and we've been involved in Afghanistan, we've been involved in with all of this weird stuff going on. The Chinese have grown stronger and stronger even still yet. And it's not that we're losing our manufacturing base. It's not that we're fighting and we're losing. No, we seem to be giving it away. And with that, the innovation that, you know, we used to depend on in this country.
Is critical.
That innovation seems to be moving over to China because the big money. has been allowed to flee over there.
You're right, it has been. And I mean, and we've done it to ourselves, which is a shame.
And that's the thing that ticks me off. We honestly didn't lose. We gave it away.
We gave it away. Like I said, it's like a free toy in the McDonald's Happy Meal. I mean, we gave them away. And that is really sad. And I don't think that anybody realized, but whether we continue to give it away, I really believe it's up to us. I mean, and I think that with the political changes that there have been, too, with this last election, and I'm not saying Republican or Democrat. I mean, I'm not picking a side. I'm just saying that there is change and that people are starting to take a hold of things. And I think if we utilize some of these changes that are occurring and we can focus the direction as opposed to the big corporations, you know, and I don't know that that's possible. I mean, we're teeny tiny little. Is that possible? Is that reality, Rick? I don't know. But I'll tell you one thing. It won't be if we don't try.
Right.
And I'm willing to at least try.
You have to.
Mm-hmm.
What else can you do? Yeah.
Nothing. It's survival. And I don't mean just of our jobs. I mean of America. And I really, truly believe that in 20 years, like my grandson, he would be able to go and look and say, oh, yeah, I saw that made when I was six. You know, but, you know, in 20 years, not only will people not know how to make it, they will have never seen it be made.
Exactly.
You know, so they won't even have that knowledge base to try to figure it out from there.
It's like all the toys I remember as a kid. Every toy I remember as a kid came from either Chicago or Massachusetts.
That's the truth. And I'll tell you, and our suppliers, where we used to supply all the time, I mean, Pressman Toy, Mattel, I can make the list. You know, Wizards of the Coast, I mean, 100 people. Mark's Toys up here. You know, Ideal Toy Company. We did all of them. And now they're all in China, every one of them. And they bring everything in directly from China. They don't manufacture their games here anymore.
Nope.
You know, they have them all manufactured in China, and they bring them all in, and they're on a pallet, and they all go to Walmart.
And they're probably forcing you to go because, hey, you know, you've got to be there for them to use your parts.
And that's true, and that's something that we've not done yet, and that's something that, you know, I mean, my dad, you know, was a critical component of this business for many years, and we grew up just believing, you know, you stick to your guns and you do what's right, and hopefully that's not going to be the only option as to what's right. You know, at least I think it's worth trying to make a positive change in America today and to realize the people that are elected to Washington, they actually work for us, all of us, not just a few of us. You know?
Well, but that's the thing. It's the people who put the big donations in their pocket are the one they're looking out for.
I know, but do you think that if we formed a unified group and a unified voice and we got loud enough? I mean, it's like a choir. One person speaking isn't going to matter. You get a bunch of us together, maybe it will.
Yeah.
I mean, we get enough people. I don't know.
I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful, but I'm not
well,
optimistic.
I'm cautiously optimistic is my term. So I'm cautiously optimistic that could, you know, maybe make a difference. I certainly know that for West Virginia, Governor Manchin, who is our governor, well, was as of yesterday, and is going into the Senate, he is very pro-business, and he will do anything he can to keep his manufacturing base and to keep manufacturing jobs in the state of West Virginia. I'm sure he will do the same thing in Washington.
That's the hope.
I know. I was going to say, well, at least initially. That'll be his goal initially. And I would hope that the big money doesn't, you know, change things because it truly matters. And so, I mean, I know that at least we have one open ear when we're over there.
I'm hoping that to be the case. Although what I've seen over the years in going up onto the hill, you know.
Yeah, I do know.
It is sad.
Doesn't it make you sick?
It makes me angry.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, so what do? We sit here and are just spoon-fed that?
I don't mind losing.
Or do we spit it out and say, I don't want to eat that anymore? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't mind losing a fight.
No.
As long as I'm allowed to fight.
That's right. As long as you don't have both arms, it's like going into a boxing ring and you've got both arms tied behind your back.
Yeah, but
the other guy, you know, has full right to swing.
Well, I mean, if you remember the Ali Tex Cobb fights.
Yes.
Where Cobb didn't throw a punch for 30 rounds. And had the idea that if he beat Ali's fists enough with his face, he might win.
Yeah, not going to happen, you know.
But he was there 30 rounds, fought two fights, 15 rounds each. Didn't go down once. Amazing.
I know, but see, we just can't let this happen. And I think that we have more control. Oh, God, I would like to think so anyway. I guess I truly believe in America and its values and, you know, the fact that, you know, Washington does work for us. We don't work for them. And that I know it's big money, and I know that. But I really think if there's enough people singing in the same choir, our voices, they have to be heard.
Yeah,
you know,
but here's my problem with that. Because I've got friends in the same socioeconomic sphere as I am who tout this free trade, that it's going to lift all boats, it's going to make everybody wealthier, everybody prospers, and my stock goes up because I have a 401k. And what's happened is you have really divided the nation on this, in my opinion, pretty equally. So there can't be consensus if you're divided equally.
There can't be consensus if it's divided equal, but you would have to take a look at, you know, what's happened too in the banking industry. I mean, the banking industry now currently represents 40% of the gross national product.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a chunk of change. And you saw how well that worked, right? I mean, you saw all the big bank bailouts. You have to make something. You have to make something. If for no other reason, and I'm dead serious when I say this, if for no other reason, defense, you have to keep things made here because you cannot. You think China's going to come bail us out? You know, like right now, there's current things for the Department of Defense that if you're working on a Department of Defense contract and they need something within 24 hours, they can take your facility over and they can manufacture it there, period.
Right.
Do you think they're going to be able to do that in China?
Not a chance. And what they've done over the years is they've actually weakened the Berry Amendment to where they can procure, I think it's up to 40% now of foreign goods.
And sometimes even more than that. And like we were bidding on a government contract, and of course there are laws in effect that say buy American if you can.
Right.
But you know that all government agencies or anybody that supplies a government agency is required to get three competitive bids. There aren't three manufacturers left in America that supply our product. So we go through it. We do all the R&D. 2 years we invest in this, and then we give them all their specs, everything they need. And then they say, you know, we don't have three competitive bids because there are not three companies in America that do this. So we're going to ask for an exclusion or an exemption to the rule. I said, fine, you know, that's great. So I'm thinking, great, that means that we got it. No, the exclusion or the exemption means they now have the opportunity to bid it globally.
And, you know, I remember when I had interviewed Hillary Clinton a number of years when she was running for president. And
mm-hmm.
I said, you know, what are we going to do about China? And she told me a couple of stories, you know, the one about the chips that go into our smart bombs. We no longer manufacture those. Those are made over in China. And the magnets that are used to make the smart bombs go where they're supposed to go, a Chinese company actually bought the company here, crated it up, shipped it back to China, and recreated it there. So we're actually, our smart bombs are made smart by Chinese products.
And see, you just got to wonder if we can't trust them with our dog food and our toothpaste and kids' toys in McDonald's Happy Meals, that they're not contaminated with lead or cadmium or some other, you know, thing that shouldn't be in them. I mean, you have to really wonder, are you going to trust them with your national defense?
Yeah, I've got some real conspiratorial friends who say that what the Chinese have actually done is they've, you know, they've put secret codes in those chips that when if the time ever comes and we shoot them off, they'll go out and they'll come back right at us.
Well, and wouldn't you think that? I mean, seriously, you know, I guess my whole life, I grew up, you know, all of us as Americans, you know, back in the 50s and 60s and stuff, we grew up, you know, communistic countries were bad. We were going to try to, you know, help, you know, the whole world, and we wouldn't deal with communistic countries. China's, you know, well, I mean, there's Cuba, but China's basically the only one left, and we are their number one source of revenue. I mean, can you explain that to me? I mean, I don't get it.
Well, I mean, there's a lot that I don't get. You know, the fact that we have this trade, this trade imbalance, that we buy all this stuff from overseas and give them our dollars, and those dollars have to come back here, and they buy us as a whole. They buy our treasury, they buy our companies, you know, they buy our roads and bridges.
And they're going to own us. And I'll tell you what, I could even tell you a scarier story than that. And this is the honest God truth. And President Obama, when he came into presidency, he did say, he called each state. Not him personally, I'm sure, but someone called each state, and they said, by golly, we can do the first thing to buy American, buy the United States Capitol, we'll buy American products, period. So if you manufacture this in your state, send us a manufacturer. We'll have a forum day, we'll do this, we'll do that, and they've had two of them. And there was a lady, we were all manufacturers from different states, and I happened to be one of them from West Virginia. So I went. And I was there in Washington, and we were all in the lines, and you went to a seminar, and then you get a ticket, and then you go see the buyers, and then you present your goods, and then, you know, and it was all a positive thing. There was a lady in there from China, and I said, I'm sorry, you must be in the wrong line, you know, because she was asking different questions, and she said, no, I'm here. And then she said, in front of this entire line of American manufacturers, she said, We said, but this is for the American manufacturers. You know, it's our forum to make presentations to the government, to the U.S. Capitol, to Buy American. And she goes, but we own you.
It's true. And if you look
we
at our
own you.
If you look at the trade negotiations and the trade laws that we've passed with each other, the treaties, we can't do any of that stuff. You can't have to the exclusion of one nation Buy American policy at all.
No, you can't, but I'll tell you, you could offset it. And I listened to a seminar that was given at the Business Summit at the Greenbrier back in September, and the gentleman that made the presentation was an economics professor, and I believe from WVU, but I'm not 100% sure that's where he was from. But anyhow, he made the presentation, and he said, if you cut foreign imports right across the board by 5%, only 5%, you would put every American back to work, every single one back to work. Cut it by 7.5%, you would put every American back to work plus 100,000 people.
And you would not have a problem with your immigration policies.
Exactly. You wouldn't.
See, to me, everything comes back to trade. Everything comes back to if you've got these jobs, if you've got this productive capacity, all of our other problems are solved.
I agree, 100%. And I think it's just presenting the message in a manner that people can hear you. You know, I think that if you understand completely, you know, the whole realm of it, you know, people listen or, you know, are being fed, for lack of a better word, this information, it's left to decipher itself. Well, you know, if you can do it really simply and just say, this is the problem. And if you're in the trenches, like we are every day, you see it, you get it, you know, where I think sometimes when you're in Washington or we're in somewhere else, you just don't get it because you don't live it. You know, you can't totally relate. And, you know, another good example, and if you watch the Colbert Show, you'll see that I said this, and actually everybody applauded, but it was a little questionable, and I didn't know that was going to be one of the questions. But he had asked me if the new health reform was going to be a detriment, and it was going to absolutely kill us as small manufacturers. And, you know, if you listen to the hype, I would have believed that. If you would have asked me that a month ago, I may have concurred with that simply by the information in the media that we've all been fed. I had to go to a seminar. You're required now because of the changes that took effect October 1st. You are required. If you give, this is commercial health insurance. This isn't national health insurance. This is commercial insurance.
It's been regulated by private insurance.
Yeah, by that policy. Okay? They've been regulated by that policy. And so you have to go to the seminar because if you provide health insurance, you have to know what changes have been made so that you can adequately convey those to your employees.
Right.
And you have to have the understanding, and the commercial insurers are making sure that you do by mandating these educational seminars. Now, going into it, I was skeptical. Coming out of it, I was amazed. I mean, I was actually amazed, you know, at the focus and at the benefit it's actually going to be to us, a small manufacturer, the corporation, from a tax basis and perspective, the credits that we can get, the offset of some of those costs. And then, two, as I was educated as a nurse, you know, and I've worked as a nurse for several years before I transitioned into this company. And I'm going to tell you, from a healthcare perspective and for an employee perspective, it is a win-win-win. It absolutely is for small manufacturers. Like our employees, if they have a $1,000 deductible, all of their wellness visits for their children and their own wellness visits as adults are free. Now, they're not free. The insurance company, of course, is going to pay them. But as opposed to getting a mammogram and having to pay $175, $245 out of your own pocket for the mammogram, there are no deductibles and there are no copays for the employees on any wellness visits, male, female, your PSAs, any of your cardiology testing, an EKG, an annual exam, after 50, a colonoscopy. Those don't come out of your pocket. Those don't come out of the deductible, and there is zero copay. There is no reason not to be healthy. None. I mean, none. And, you know, and that was impressive. The other thing where on our policy as it was written, there were certain things, and a knee replacement this amount, hip this amount, or just even any kind of surgeries, TMJ, which is your jaw.
Temporal.
You know, $1,000 was the max limit. Well, you know, it's a joint.
Yep.
All joints are treated the same. You get it fixed, it's done right. End of story. Employees that I'd hire, you know, maybe they would come and they would be eligible for insurance, but it wouldn't cover a pre-existing condition for a year. So they had insurance, but nothing that would treat diabetes. I'm going to use that as an example, a diabetic. So, you know, all those costs were offset. Now they are covered the minute that that policy goes into effect.
And for me, the other part of this, and to put myself in your shoes, the other part of this is you're not in the business of doing health insurance. You're in the business of making marbles.
Absolutely.
Why not take the health insurance off the back of the employers and say, you know what, go do what you want to do. In your
exactly.
case, make marbles.
You know, that's right. Let us make marbles. And you know what? But this is going to be, it is going to be better for them. And hopefully we're going to have a healthier workforce because of it. And when I actually got the information one-on-one, straight to straight, you know, my feelings were much different, and I could honestly see where it was a benefit. And, you know, no lifetime max. Well, okay, how's that going to equate to cost? It may at some point, but what do they think it costs to health care? And I was chairman of the board of the hospital over here for 12 years, so let me tell you, from that perspective, too, and we're in a rural community, so maybe 2 out of 5 people actually had insurance, so 3 people didn't. And they don't think that doesn't equate to the cost of health care? Trust me, it does, because a CT scan could cost maybe $500 if 5 people were paying for it, but it's going to cost $2,500 if only 2 out of 5 are paying for it.
Yep.
And you know, they just don't get it. But you know, it is the way it is. And I, you know, it was funny because when I was going to the Colbert show, I was in Pittsburgh and I was in a shuttle, and we were all going to New York, and so they were going over, and these two guys, some lady was talking to them, and she finally said, "Where are you from?" And they go, "We don't even want to tell you." And their heads were down. They were businessmen dressed up. And then she goes, "Oh, come on." She goes, "Well, it used to be a city, but now it's a shell of a city that is deteriorating every day." And their heads were down, and she continued to pursue that. And then finally they said Detroit. And I was just listening in the conversation. And then as we exited the shuttle, they go, "So what are you going to New York for?" And I said, "I'm actually going to be on Comedy Central with Stephen Colbert tonight." And they looked at me and, of course, first laughed. And I said, "No, I'm serious." And they go, "What do you do there?" I said, "I'm going to try to see to it, or at least make the voice heard, to keep other cities from turning into Detroit and to keep American workers working." You know, I said, honestly. And I said, somebody has to do something. And I'm, you know, tonight I'm going to be that somebody. And they actually left, and when they were flying Delta, I was flying JetBlue. We all said goodbye. They said good luck. I said, yeah, nothing better to do tonight. New York, turn it on. I'm sure it'll be funny, you know, if nothing else. So then when I went and was sitting at my gate, those two gentlemen had come all the way from one terminal to the next to come back to that JetBlue terminal, and they both thanked me. And I mean, not just sort of thanked me, Rick. I mean, it was all the one man could do not to cry. And, I mean, he was that emotional about that. He goes, "Good luck tonight, and we told you that earlier, but we just want to say, hey, thank you for being that somebody. Thank you."
Somebody's got to do it.
And they meant it. You know, he goes, all of us say, somebody needs to do something, but nobody does. And he said, "So I thank you." I go, "Well, you do realize I may be ripped into pieces tonight." And he goes,
"Because you never know. You never know."
"No, you don't." And so I said, but you know, it's a chance I'm willing to take. I said, but it's for a good cause. And if I am, I am, you know, but if it makes even a minute difference, if one person, you know, changes and says, hey, maybe we can do something, you know, maybe this, I mean, I mean, the example I used to those guys in the airport was, we're not all 10 soldiers. I mean, you know, we're not all just marching down this little, you know, like at the Nutcracker. We're not all just 10 soldiers marching in a line. We have a choice.
Yep.
So I don't know. That's my idealistic goal, Rick. You know, whether or not it'll ever come to, you know, some sort of reality of change, I could only hope.
Well, that's why we wake up every morning.
That is why we wake up every morning, absolutely.
Because we don't have any other choice.
That's, you know, well, you do, but you don't want to take it, Rick. Come on, you know.
Excellent point.
Yes, you do. You always got a choice in life, but, you know, you just want to make good ones.
And a good one would be to go to MarbleKingUSA.com and buy some marbles. Keep Marble King in business, the last marble maker in the United States. And we should all get there for the holiday season. Barry Fox, I appreciate your time again. MarbleKingUSA.com. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this.
Don't let us get old. Don't let us get stupid. All right. Just make us be brave. Make us play nice. Let us be together tonight.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class. Rick Smith. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Of all the things you'd want the President of the United States to tackle right after November's congressional elections, how high on your list of priorities would you put the task of selling weapons to India? It seems that even the fall tilling of Michelle Obama's White House garden would be a more worthy presidential pursuit than peddling military hardware. November's elections didn't go all that well for Obama, and he has a giant to-do list to go through if he's to convince America's workaday majority that he's really working for them. Yet, the weekend after the election, his first move was to fly 8,000 miles away to try to convince the Indian government to buy $5 billion worth of military hardware from Boeing and a mess of other weaponry from Lockheed Martin and other U.S. arms dealers. Screwy priorities aside, however, why the hell is the President of the United States of America playing Willie Loman for corporate arms hawkers? Yeah, I know they claim that the selling of killing machines creates jobs, but is war and death the only product America has to hawk to the world these days? Besides, India requires that a third of the work on the planes, missiles, and other armaments it buys be farmed out to its manufacturers, creating jobs there, not here. One other dicey point. India is stockpiling weaponry as part of its ever-escalating confrontation with its neighbor and bitter rival, Pakistan, a U.S. ally that our arms dealers also supply. How long before American soldiers get caught in this deadly crossfire of U.S.-made weapons? This is Jim Hightower saying, pretensions aside, Obama's trip to India is not about jobs, but about fattening the bottom line of war profiteers. The arms trade is immoral. It fuels perpetual war, and the President of the United States ought not be its traveling salesman.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go With the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
Soon as you're born, they make you feel small. I've given you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all.
It's class warfare. My class is winning, but they shouldn't be.
A working class hero is something to eat.
The taxation system has tilted toward the rich and away from the middle class.
A working class hero is something to be.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. Also, if you want to email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com during the email. During the break, I got an email from Helen pointing out a couple of websites where you can get American-made products, toysmadeinamerica.com and fractiles.com, two places where you can go to find products made right here in the U.S. Yeah, because that's really, honestly and truthfully, for me, it's a challenge. You know, I've got kids. I want to ensure that, you know, it's weird. I think I've got the only third grader one of the only third graders in the country who go around asking their friends, is that made in the U.S.? Are those made by union workers?
God bless her.
Well, you know,
you joke about it, but you know what? I've seen families where I worked. Husband and wife, mother and father worked for years, provided a good family, and you know one thing they never did is talk about union made and buying American. And that's a shame, because what allowed them to live a good life was the people who went before to ensure that their jobs were kept in America. So God bless her.
In fact, my daughter turned around. We went trick-or-treating, and my daughter turned around and goes, Dad, is this union candy?
Did she really? Hey, you're training her right, Rick.
Because it was something that, you know, she hadn't seen before. You know, she knows the Hershey brands, and she does like the Reese's. She likes that, even though that's not really union candy. But it is made in the U.S.
Just so make sure you don't buy the Mexican, please.
You know how if you have the Mexican candy, don't you?
Yeah, it's written on the package.
Well, that's the one where you're sitting on the pot for the next 3 hours.
Oh.
It's a good laxative. They use that good Mexican water. Helps push everything out there.
Well, you know, you bring up an interesting subject. I personally, not, first of all, I wouldn't buy it, but I wouldn't, I literally wouldn't trust Mexico either. You make a legit point.
There you go, being nationalistic again. Jeez.
Well, it's more than that. If you knew where actually Hershey put their new plant, well, about a year ago.
Tell me, where did Hershey put their new plant?
I believe it's down in Monterey.
Okay, you know. Monterey.
Here's the thing.
No, because I don't know. You said if you know.
Here's the thing. No, my point is this. The area is actually controlled. And I mean, this is ironic. It is actually controlled. Or it's an area where the government and the drug kingpins are fighting for territorial rights. And they actually sabotaged the grid 2 years ago. And the Hershey plant didn't run for a whole week. And I thought, well, you know what? You dumb you-know-whats. You should have thought about that before you took thousands of good-paying American jobs down to Mexico. It was like, oops, we didn't know. Well, I guess you know now.
Oh, no, they knew. It was just more profit.
It was too enticing. It was too enticing.
Another company we've been talking about, this Express Scripts, and we talked about them a while ago. I had a couple of guests on from Express Scripts. They're the nation's second-largest pharmacy benefits manager. Well, they've announced that they're going to be closing one of the two facilities they have outside of Philadelphia. The closure, I understand, is supposed to December 16th. So Merry Christmas, you're fired, is basically what they're saying. 350 people out into the cold, 9 days before Christmas. Merry Christmas to you and your family. In addition, Express Script is also threatening to close a second facility. They want to fire another 650 workers for a total of 1,000 workers. You got to look at these monster companies, these big multi-state, multinational companies like Express Script, like Dr. Pepper, Snapple. They see what's going on with the economy. They see an opportunity to really stick it to their workers. And look, I understand helping out a company when they need help. If they're in serious trouble, you got to help them. You need to save them. You need to do what you can because really you're saving yourself as well. But when a company is as profitable as Mott's was, Dr. Pepper Snapple, as this Express Script is, you kind of figure out it's all about the greed. It's all about the bottom line. How much can we put into our pocket? And some of the numbers from this Express Script place is just mind blowing. They posted earnings of $1.7 billion.